to Shattering News. Before we continue with the news, I must take issue with the advertisement in the midst of the Salem Radio News cast. I continue to be disgusted that GCN doesn't deploy a more credible news source, but since they are unwilling to, then occasionally the commercials that are embedded in the news need to be taken to task. Franklin Graham's organization wants to promote the Easter Cross of Billy Graham. Well, it's just astonishing to me that Christians are still clinging to Easter. It's named after Ishtar, the Babylonian queen of heaven and mother of God. Ishtar was married to Lord Baal. She claimed that the sun impregnated her on Ishtar, Easter Sunday, so that 9 months later on the winter solstice, today celebrated as Christmas, that she would give birth to the son of the sun. It has no, absolutely no godly orientation, no godly background of any kind. It is a purely pagan, purely revolting sun god festival that was born and bred in Babylon. That's the nature of Easter. If you are a Christian like Franklin Graham promoting Easter, you should be ashamed. You ought not to do it. And to promote it on a radio program is revolting. Yahweh, which is God's one and only name, invited us to participate in Pesach, Passover, matzah, unyeasted bread, and Bukurim, firstborn children, on the 14th, 15th, and 16th day of the first month of the year. The month of Abib, when barley is still green and receptive in the kernels of the plant. It occurs very similar time to what Easter has been established. Easter has been established by Roman Catholicism and then by Protestant Christianity taking their lead, so that it is always close to but never officially overlaps Yahweh's invitations to meet with him. A Passover on yeasted bread and firstborn children. Easter is a pure counterfeit, a fraud, designed to take people's attention away from the days that God invited us to meet with him. If you are celebrating it, you are not only doing something that is overtly offensive to God, but you're not meeting with him on the days that are capable of saving you. There is no salvation in Easter, only damnation. There is salvation and eternal life and Pesach, matzah, and Bukurim, even adoption into Yahweh's covenant family. Moving from Easter to cross, there is no cross. Not even in the so-called Christian New Testament. Never once is anything remotely akin to a cross mentioned. The implement is an upright pole. Staros in Greek, Edon in Hebrew. And the participants whose discussions are recorded spoke Hebrew. It's an Edon. It's an upright pole, upright pillar. It's the upright post that holds up the tabernacle. The upright one stood up for us so that we could stand with him on Pesach, on Matzah, and on Bukurim. A cross is a pagan symbol. It was part of the religion of Babylon, of the Egyptians, of the Greeks, and of the Romans. There is no salvation in the cross. And, of course, Franklin Graham could not get Yahusha's name right, calling him instead Jesus, a name that was made up in the 17th century that bears absolutely no resemblance whatsoever to Yahusha or to Yahweh. Everything they were promoting is not only a lie, but there isn't a single person who has ever been saved by Billy Graham, by Jesus, by a cross or by participating in Easter. Not one. Moving on, I'd like to share a story. This was written for CNN by CNN's national security analyst, a man that I have very low regard for, but his stories are always interesting in that they tell us about the myths that are being perpetrated in politics and by the media. Again, if you'd like to challenge anything that I'm saying or just add your insights, 877-300-7645. He writes, the world's most powerful democracy and the world's most absolute monarchy have long been close, if unlikely, allies. The monarchy that he's speaking of is Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is not a country in the sense of having a the people of that country join together for their own benefit, but instead is a private estate, as are most of the Islamic majority countries. They're either theocracies, military dictatorships, or fiefdoms. Most of the countries around Saudi Arabia are fiefdoms. Should be called that, as opposed to a monarchy. The king of Saudi Arabia is only king because he was the grandchild of the man who became a warlord who was rewarded by the British for opposing the Ottoman Turks in the First World War. He's not royal. He's just a warlord and a family of warlords. Peter Bergen writes, the United States and Saudi Arabia are bound by common interest, the free flow of oil, and more recently fighting Al-Qaeda. That's utter rubbish. The primary mechanism for funding fundamentalist Islamic terrorist is Saudi Arabia. They provide the fuel that ignites Islamic terrorism. It is no surprise that the vast preponderance of those Muslims who flew planes into America's buildings on 9/11 were citizens of Saudi Arabia. Most of the most fundamentalist mosques in the world are built by and funded by Saudi Arabia. They have no interest in fighting fundamentalist Islam. Now, if it's fighting Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda exists today of one individual, Ayman al-Zawahiri. That's it. There is no Al-Qaeda beyond Ayman al-Zawahiri. And he is an uncharismatic man that very few people care about or listen to. And even when Al-Qaeda existed of he and Osama bin Laden, which it did for about a decade, no one listened to either of them. We have absolute proof of this. Fighting Al-Qaeda is a myth that is being deployed to control you. That's it. It's a means that the government can say your movements need to be restricted. Your communications, whether they be on the internet or on the telephone, need to be overheard, need to be evaluated. Your privacy is no longer of concern to us. You must be searched at the airport when you wish to fly. You must undress to get on an airplane. You must fund the government's removal of your freedom. You must fund the government's continued investment in the military, in the police, in the judicial system to fight this menacing foe which does not exist. But that's what governments do. To justify their ability to control people through the military, through police, through a jail system, through a judicial system, through a military, to control people's access to information, to be able to spy on them, they always create a pretend foe. Now, that's not to say there aren't fundamentalist Muslims who are terrorists. There are. They commit 99% of the world's terrorist acts. They're just not Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is a fraud. It's never been meaningful. It wasn't even meaningful on 9/11. It's irrelevant. And you can't say, and this is the problem of Peter Bergen, you can't say that we have a common goal of fighting fundamentalist Islam. Well, fundamentalist Islam is the cause of all Islamic terrorism, 100% of it. But you can't say that Saudi Arabia has a common interest in fighting fundamentalist Islam when they are fundamentalist Muslims. So you have to use Al-Qaeda as if it was a real organization, as if it had troops, as if it had weapons, as if it had means and a separate agenda. As for the free flow of oil, that's never what Americans have ever wanted, because if you look at Saudi Arabia, they simply stole American investment in those oil fields. America was negotiated, Standard Oil happened to be, negotiated exclusive rights to develop Saudi Arabian oil reserves. They built the refineries. They built the pipelines. They built the distribution facilities. They even built most of the super tankers. And then the Saud warlords stole them. And along with other Muslims, created OPEC for the express purpose of controlling the flow of oil and overcharging for it. And that which cost 25 cents a barrel to extract from the ground, they were now charging $100 a barrel for. And so that they could impose their religious will when, for example, America wouldn't join with them in the Six-Day War or the Yom Kippur War against Israel. So everything this man writes is untrue. It's grossly untrue. The opposite happens to be true. And you have to ask yourself, so why would CNN employ someone who they call a national security analyst to deliberately lie? Why is CNN touting the same message that's being touted by the American political leadership when both are so obviously untrue? I mean, it doesn't take a genius to show you the difference between the truth and what this man writes, what our leaders say. So why are they in cahoots with one another? Why aren't there more people saying, shame on you? Why are you lying in this way? The opposite is true. Because the truth matters. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Before I continue to shatter the credibility of Peter Bergen writing for CNN, there were a couple of headlines that I wanted to bring to your attention from the Washington Post. The first of them that caught my eye was, and this is now the top eight stories presented by the Washington Post this morning. It says, the good wife follows the shocking death with a plot that is, actually, I'll read this exactly as it is because it's just amazing to be real. But it's the good wife follows the shocking death with a brutal episode. Now, do you think maybe the Washington Post is aware that no actors were actually harmed in the production of the episode? That the actor who was presented as having died really didn't die? I mean, there is this disclaimer, you know, that no animals were harmed. Well, people are animals, and no people were harmed in the production of that episode. You know, this is not news to report on the shocking death of a character in a TV show. And a brutal episode, I mean, who cares? It's imaginary. I mean, the blood is red dye. Don't fret. It's going to be okay. The next headline, this is actually the top headline on Washington Post this morning. For a productive workforce, try chocolate. Apparently, employers can buy happiness, or at least they can boost productivity in the workplace by about 12%, according to research presented to the Washington Post. I mean, what happened to that newspaper? I know that Katharine Graham sold them to Bezos of Amazon. And I know that Amazon lives in a world of the Ethernet, of the ether of the Internet. But goodness, What happened to at least the pretense of credibility? There was also a news report. In fact, it's in everybody's news top 10 list that America is negotiating with the Russians. But how does one negotiate when you begin your negotiation by saying we can't negotiate until you meet our demands? And in this particular case, the demand by the United States is that the Russians stop assembling their troops in Russia. Well, I know you're Russians, and I know that you Russians have a military that's about one-tenth the size of the American military. And I know that we aren't going to tolerate you telling us where we can have our troops, and they're all over the world. But we're here to tell you, you can't have your troops in your country. I mean, and there isn't a single one of the news reporting agencies that has the common sense to say, what in the world are we thinking? That is, with a country that has its troops deployed in bases all over the world and ships menacing every country on earth, and with a country that has invaded two countries and occupied them just in the last decade, Afghanistan and Iraq, and a country that bombed Libya, and a country that deploys its drones and has killed 4,000 people in other people's countries with drones, and we're telling the Russians that your troops can't march in Russia? And that's a prerequisite for having a discussion with us? Particularly when the number one candidate for election has said, I think we should scorch Russia and kill ethnic Russians in Ukraine? Good grief, what's wrong with us? Well, now returning to this article, Peter Bergen says that this alliance with America was first sealed between President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Saudi King Abdul Aziz Al Saud. He forgot that part. That's why the country is named Saudi Arabia. On February 14th, 1945, when they met on the deck of the USS Quincy as the American warship sailed through the Suez Canal. FDR and his advisors knew that oil, of which Saudi Arabia was well endowed, was a key component of America's economy. Indeed, Standard Oil of California had signed a far-sighted deal, according to Peter Bergen, a decade earlier, giving it exclusive production rights in Saudi Arabia. Yes, nothing portends fairness. Nothing is better for efficiency than having a monopoly, an exclusive production right. Oh, so far-sighted, so wonderful of you. Speaking as a media liberal that would like to see all power concentrated in a few hands, yes, indeed, monopolies, exclusivities, far-sighted. Nothing speaks of freedom better than absolute control. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. A couple of more comments from the Peter Bergen article. We'll return to it in a minute, but we have Kirk on the line. But before I go to Kirk, I would like to share two additional paragraphs. This is from the Peter Bergen article. Thomas Lippman, who has written authoritatively on U.S.-Saudi relations, wrote that as a result of the meeting on the Quincy, the American president gave the Saudi king a DC-3 airplane. We gave him a DC-3 airplane. And this is the same Saudi king, by the way, that stole Standard Oil's investment, confiscated it in Saudi Arabia, and created OPEC, that nearly bankrupt America, and used that as a weapon of war to aid and abet the Islamic attack on Israel. But we gave him a DC-3 airplane that was specifically outfitted with a rotating throne, which allowed the king to always face the holy site of Mecca while he was in the air. Now, isn't there something just revolting about that? That FDR would think that it was in America's interest to give this fundamentalist Muslim, who would supply 80% of the 9/11 suicide bombers, a DC-3 airplane, one outfitted with a rotating throne. We're a democracy, or actually a republic, and we're going to honor a king, a dictator, with a rotating throne, one facing Mecca, the source of 99.9% of the world's terrorism. Now, for his part, King Abdulaziz al-Saud enjoyed his meals as the president's guest on board the Quincy, so much so that he surprised his host with an unusual demand. He wanted to take the Quincy's cook for himself. FDR was able to diplomatically ward off the request. He said the concept that human beings are not personal property didn't come to the Saudi kingdom until relatively late. Slavery was only abolished there in 1962, and it was only abolished on paper. It still exists. That's why most countries won't allow anyone to accept a work visa to go to Saudi Arabia, because the moment the person enters Saudi Arabia working for members of this royal family, their passports are confiscated. Whatever they promise to pay the person is cut by 90%, and then they are tortured by the royal family members. They'll have burns over most of their bodies. They'll have knife wounds. They will be routinely beaten with rods and not allowed to leave, having no means to leave the country because their passports have been stolen. Now, they haven't gotten over that slavery was outlawed because they're Muslims. That said, Kirk, welcome to the program. I probably do need a break. I'm not real pleased with the news of today.
Well, I was actually going to ask something about what you were discussing, and I was away from the radio for just a moment, but my question initially that prompted the call was Standard Oil being the Rockefellers, I think, before they broke it all up.
That's correct.
Well, if we're always touting, as a government, we're always touting, we have interest in this country, which usually means economic interest, why is it that they would allow the Sauds to take over the oil fields?
Really? Yeah, I know. It is so interesting that America, big time. But I'm not surprised that Rockefeller negotiated an exclusive in Saudi Arabia. Now, the only way you could do that is to bribe the Saud family. I mean, that is the means to do that. So he got exclusivity over Saudi Arabia, which has, 20% of the world's proven oil reserves? Now, as Americans, we shouldn't have thought that was a very good idea, for an American company to have an exclusivity over something that powerful. But then, you know, long after the Rockefellers have lost most of their interest in Standard Oil, because America sought to do the opposite in America as to what happened in Saudi Arabia. Of course, with OPEC, it's a monopoly, and Standard Oil had a monopoly. Standard Oil didn't have a monopoly in America, although they had a growing share, but America specifically broke them into pieces. Now, what's interesting, and that therefore, when OPEC happened, it's no longer a Rockefeller interest because he had been divested of these things. But what's interesting, of course, is that since that breakup, what we've seen is a reamalgamation, all with government approval, of the oil business, and it's now been reamalgamized, if you will, under largely international control. I mean, if you just look at any state, you live in California. In California, there was Exxon, Mobil, Chevron, and 76 were all large suppliers of gas, of retail gas. And they were all competitors. Mobil was huge. Exxon was huge. Chevron was probably the largest, followed in California by Union 76. You know, they're all one company now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was Sinclair on and on and on and on and on.
Oh, on and on. Yeah. I've left off two-thirds of them. You know, it's the same thing's true in banking, by the way. You know that we need to have competition in banking. But if you look at the banks that no longer exist in any state, you know, take California as an example. Like Bank of America, it doesn't exist anymore. Yes, you will see ads and signs that say Bank of America. No, it's just it happens to be Nations Bank that bought Bank of America and merged Bank of America into Nations Bank and said, you know, I like the name Bank of America better than I like the name Nations Bank. But there are probably 80% fewer banks, meaningful size banks operating in America now.
Oh, yeah.
The same thing is true with airlines. You know, the means to travel. They're all joined together. Yeah, there are airplanes now that say U.S. Air and American, the same company. U.S. Air bought the bankrupt American. You know, it's just one after another. We have formulated means to eliminate competition.
Okay, now phasing into the second part of the question is these people who... You know, you've hobnobbed at least with the rich and powerful, so
yes.
And politicians and so forth.
Yes, I have.
What is it in them when you gain all this?
Mm-hmm.
And you see, but like the Clinton family, he retires and he's got all of a sudden $100 million in his account and all that sort of thing.
Right.
Where are they putting their money? The money's no good.
Right.
Inflation.
Correct.
I mean, I know that Ted Turner. Bought is the biggest landholder, one of the biggest landholders in the country, and he bought up half of New Mexico and that sort of thing. And
well, that's after buying up a huge portion of Montana.
Montana
the largest,
yeah.
I think he's the largest landowner in Montana, too.
But his biggest holders now are in this report I read the other day is in New Mexico. But regardless, with everything.
When was the last time?
Are they so dumb that they don't see that all of this is so short-lived? I mean.
Yeah. It's interesting to watch people accumulate vast amounts of wealth as if they, you know, think they're going back to the days of the pharaohs in Egypt and can be buried with their loot and have huge memorials built to protect their body that will sail off into the afterlife with all of this loot. You know, the idea of the of he who has the most money upon their death wins. But you have to ask yourself, so what is the purpose? Is the purpose that you want to have a living legacy of your name, of Ted Turner owned all these things and owned all this land, therefore he was a mighty man, and that's going to make a difference somehow once you're dead?
No, I just don't get the motive. I mean,
yeah.
I understand some people, but it seems like we collectively they're all doing this sort of thing.
Why is this existing? And why are all the mergers? Well, you know, why does U.S. Air buy American, for example, out of bankruptcy? Why does Nations Bank buy Bank of America when they are essentially bankrupt because they were forced to buy World Bank? Why do the officers and boards of large companies merge to create less healthy, larger companies? And, you know, as I met these folks, like George W. Bush, I spent a fair amount of time with before and after he was elected president. John McClown, the senator of Arizona, spent a lot of
great
time with him as well. Yeah, thank you. It seems to be fitting. And it's really about power, control. There, you reach a point, I think most of these folks reach a point where they have more money than they can spend. And so the only thing left to play for is control and power. And so that's how they play the game and power and control don't typically come by way of business, although businesses are blamed. I think that there's this misconception in the West, and particularly in America, that corporations, that the bankers and businessmen and international conglomerates are to blame for their condition. This, if you listen to this show, the commercials that play or make it sound like that pharmaceutical companies are trying to kill you. You know, that's not where power comes from. Power does not come from business. power comes from politics. And so it's the integration of business and government together, like Halliburton, for example, and the and war-making capability for the United States, or for Lockheed Martin and the war-making capability of the United States. It's these kind of alliances that turn business and government influence collectively into a power base. It's why the Clintons, you know, he's a guy born into a very poor family.
Oh, yeah.
And now he has hundreds of millions of dollars. So how does he have hundreds of millions of dollars, having been born into a poor family and having the only job that he really ever had was being government of a essentially bankrupt state, the poorest state in the union, and then becoming president of the United States? How do you accumulate that kind of money? And why aren't we concerned about that? You know, you look at George Bush. He was an absolute failure in business. Every business he owned went bankrupt. Nothing that he had from a business perspective prevailed, and yet he's a multimillionaire, living with a huge ranch in Texas and a huge home in Dallas, and flying all around the world in a private aircraft. But shouldn't we be concerned about the graft, about the reasons that people really run for political office? Look at Obama. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a conversation with Kirk. And Kirk, you raise an interesting point. What on earth causes the kinds of elitists that are accumulating such vast array of power and wealth? You know, a guy like Erdogan in Turkey. What causes him to want to consolidate his power by depriving others of their freedoms, of their wealth, of their lives? Well, what ultimately did they have to gain? You know, when Rockefeller died, was there something that he thought maybe he had achieved in accumulating all of this wealth? Was there a Brinks truck that accompanied him down his funeral? Do you think that the bed of his coffin is lined with $1,000 bills?
The whole thing kind of bizarre, isn't it?
It really is. You know, you look at Obama, a guy who never worked for a business a day in his life. When he, his college education was essentially paid for by the U.S. taxpayer, and he goes and he uses an extraordinarily expensive college degree that he didn't pay for to be an organizer in Chicago. It's a political activist in Chicago to organize a grassroots political response in Illinois, and from there gets to run for U.S. Senate and a vacant seat, and because whoever wins the Democratic primary, which is really set up as opposed to voted on, wins that seat because there's not a Republican that has a prayer in that state of prevailing, and as a first-term senator, then becomes president. And in his first actions, he demeans business, and particularly demeans their use of private aircraft. The aircraft industry in America has just crashed as a result. And then he goes and sends his wife off on personal vacations on Air Force One and travels all around the world and the country on Air Force One. And now has millions of dollars when he's never worked in business one day in his life, never earned a dime. And you say, you know, something's seriously wrong with this picture.
Why are there so few that seem to get it? I mean, you're almost like the voice crying in the wilderness.
I mean, boy, sure feel like
they're
it.
I know, and you should, because you listen to it, and everybody comes up with every kind of theory in the world, but what's common sense? And it doesn't.
What you just said is really funny. The reason I think it's funny is that we do have the only program that actually is taking these government, military, and religious institutions to task, and yet all we're wielding at them is common sense. I mean, I don't think there's any other program that dresses down Erdogan and says, wait a minute, You know, everything that's in this article is the opposite of what's actually true. Or here FDR and his response to the Saudi Arabians or Peter Bergen in the media and say, no, wait a minute. Everything he's claimed here as the preamble to his article is the opposite of what's true. And all we're really wielding is common sense, right?
Yeah, it's not deep stuff. I mean, child could figure this out. I mean,
but it's. I want to say two things. One is you're right. There is nothing difficult about this, which then begs the question: why aren't more people doing it? Because, Kirk, it's important. This notion of patriotism, that we ought to go off and march off to war, that we ought to support this government. When the government is essentially corrupt, when the government is working against our interests, when the people that we're empowering are lying to us while enriching themselves, this is important that people know that they ought not be doing these things. And it's so obvious that the human institutions are corrupt, you would think that more people would be motivated to expose them.
Well, you know, like your thing this morning on the Ukraine.
Yes.
And we're loaning them money, and everyone I know knows that the IMF is American dollar funded. And everybody also knows we're $17 trillion in debt.
Right, right.
And yet your point about why are we giving these people money, borrowing money on our
right.
debt in order to give them something that they'll never pay us back, and we can't afford to pay it back. Pay our debt back, so it becomes so ludicrous. You want to just throw your hands in the air and run off down the room or something.
Yeah, Kirk, stay with us through this break. I agree with you 100%.